Kristen here. Thanks so much for listening to Election Intrigue, the podcast. It's November 1st. We have less than 4 days to go until the U.S. presidential elections. So John and I have a little bit of a longer episode planned as we have a lot to get through. We're going to look at each campaign's closing pitches with Vice President Harris's pitches in Washington, D.C. and Donald Trump in New York City at Madison Square Garden. And then we'll investigate if newspapers should really be endorsing candidates, including with some data pulled from our own Intrigue readers on what they think if candidates should be endorsed by newspapers or not. As well as then we'll do a round of what each country might be thinking or wanting for a candidate. Granted, whoever lands in the Oval Office in January, we are sure each country around the world will the vast majority will work with the United States, but relationships might change. And John kind of gives a rundown on why and for what each capital is thinking, as well as we'll talk about this in-between period of time from Election Day to Inauguration Day, when it looks like that could really be a concern if it's unclear exactly who won and if either of the candidates do not concede. All right, so let's get into it. Once more, a plug for International Intrigue. Our daily newsletter lands in your inbox every weekday morning with news from around the world from a geopolitical lens. All right, let's dive right in. Hey, John, how are you?
Oh, I'm excited for the election. I'm not sure if it's excited for the relief of being through the election and kind of the constant drumbeat of news, or just that it's an exciting thing. I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. Maybe I'm just that much of a political nerd that it's exciting.
Yeah. Well, it got real for me this week in DC because Harris made her closing remarks on Tuesday evening at the Ellipse, which was symbolic. Yes. Because that's where Donald Trump, former President Donald Trump, when he gave his last remarks before January 6th, was there. So there was a symbolic meaning to it.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about this. It's a good way to start off the podcast. So I think we're going to do a bit of a longer podcast today because it's the final edition before the election next Tuesday. But what better way to start than you were actually at this rally, this campaign event that Harris hosted. And again, as for folks who missed this in the news, it was a huge rally right under the Washington Monument in front of the White House. What was it like being there?
Yeah. I mean, what I will say is where I was, even though I was so close to the stage, I was in sort of like an ADA press area where you have basically like a smaller group than the main group. I was still looking at screens, and it felt so different when I looked at the screen than when I looked around me at the people right next to me.
How far away from the stage were you?
Maybe about 50 feet.
Okay.
No, maybe a little more, maybe 100. Let's double it. Because when I think about even the space between like where she was on stage. Yeah, it was pretty close. Like I could see people in the first sort of back rows of the stage, right?
And for our non-American listeners, that's about 30 meters, just to translate into metric system, which is by far the better system. But anyway, that's not what this podcast is about.
It was one of those, you know, it was interesting because when I looked at it on the jumbo screen, it was like, wow, this looks like a massive, huge event, like how they do the cameras. And
well, they said 70,000 people roughly there, right?
Yeah. And that's why I'm confused if maybe like I was almost in like a separate area, because it really didn't feel like 70,000. It really didn't even feel like 20,000.
Do you think she was going all Trump and claiming it was the biggest crowd ever, but it was actually not the biggest crowd?
Well, so I've been thinking about this over the past few days, because it's one of those things where I'm like, wait, I was physically there, but I don't feel like there was 70,000 people.
That's interesting. I have a theory on that we'll get to later about the fact that it doesn't actually matter for the people who are in the crowd. It's all about the people watching the people.
Yeah.
In the crowd. So it's like folks on TV, folks on, you know, the media talking about the rally, even if the people there are like, huh, it was fine, I don't mind, but it was like not amazing.
Right. And it, the energy, like I remember my one friend right after, she was like even more, you know, more front row, got right there at like 3 or maybe even 2 or good something Lord. Before.
I'll never get used to the American enthusiasm for turning up to listen to politicians. In Australia, they might get 20 people.
Well, I will say I do know some people who are like, well, I think maybe Taylor Swift will perform because like Beyonce had performed a few days
DNC
early.
DNC all over again. The rumors about the convention all over again. I was at a concert for Barack Obama during his first inauguration or right up before his first inauguration in that same place, like right near the reflecting pool there on the other side of the monument. Barack didn't speak, but it was just, it was really weird to me. Well, not weird, but just how many Americans treat politicians and the president particularly, but just generally politicians like absolute celebrities. It's a very weird dynamic for those of us who aren't American.
Yeah. It's a weird dynamic for me too, a bit, just cause I feel very detached, from the election candidates. Like, I feel like
you cover politics, but you aren't kind of like, you don't, it's not that you don't care, but you're not like, I'm on team red or I'm on team blue.
Right. I feel like I can kind of step back and look at it like, okay, this is what this person said. This is what that person said, which sometimes scares me because I am a voting American. So it feels like maybe I should be more up in arms, but I don't. Like, I think that people have the,
I think that's healthy, Kristen,
the valid right to vote, and they can vote. They have the valid right to vote in each direction. Anyways, but so I've been thinking about this over the last few days because on the screens, even just looking at the jumbo screens, it looked so much bigger of an event than it felt on the ground. It also felt like but here's the thing. I've also never been to a Trump rally. I mean, I've been to the RNC, been to the DNC, but that's different. Like, you have the super hardcore, like everyone is going to shout and cheer for everything. It did feel like when people made statements that really resonated with the base that was there for Harris, they would like wave their flag up once and be like, woo, and then put it down, which is not what I've seen on TV of like Trump rallies with like, you just have much energy and rah, rah. But I think if you were watching the Harris one on TV, you would also think there was rah, rah, which I didn't necessarily feel on the ground.
There's a Trump rally in New Hampshire this weekend. So maybe I'll drive up out of Boston into New Hampshire and report back. Although, I don't know, that doesn't seem like the most fun way to spend my weekend, but we'll see.
But certainly an interesting one. One time I had...
It would be interesting.
I don't even really know if I should share this, but I will. one time I had a foreign correspondent tell me, a European foreign correspondent at a big newspaper, they had, and before, even when Biden was still in, so I think sometimes you have to caveat when Biden was still in, but he would go to a lot of the Trump speeches to report on them. And he would say, you know, sometimes I do catch myself really like listening and being like, oh, wow.
Getting
swept up. And I think that it's hard not to in any sort of rally at Harris or Trump. Like, you're in the sphere.
He's very popular. 70-something million Americans are going to vote for him. Like, he's popular. That's not nothing. There is a reason for him. One of the reasons is he's a charismatic showman at a rally, and that's a powerful tool, which actually leads me to, let's move on to kind of zooming out from the Harris rally, because I actually thought her speech there was it was probably the best speech I've heard her give. And that's obviously her closing argument. So let's talk about the two candidates' closing arguments in the election. So what I liked about, and when I say what I liked, I'm talking about a political analysis, not personally my politics, but what I liked about is that it's for the first time I heard her really describe and clearly enunciate why she's running for president and who she is. And she said something like, along the lines of, when I see people getting taken advantage of, when I see people who the system isn't working for, who are getting kind of run over by whatever the situation is, whether it's big business, whether it's taxes, whatever the problem is, that doesn't sit well with me. And I have fought my whole career to prevent that stuff from happening. It's the first time that I've ever thought about like, oh, I kind of get who you are and why you run, why you're in politics, like why you were the Attorney General in San Francisco or the DA in San Francisco, why you ran for Senate. Like you don't like to see injustice. Now you can agree or disagree with that, but it was a clear enunciation of what she will do or who she is as president. And I thought it was compelling in a way that she just has not been compelling yet. So I don't know. Did you get that sense in on the ground or in the media afterwards?
Yeah, I completely agree with that being probably your strongest point. And for this very reason, Trump gained a lot of traction for saying he was outside government, that he hadn't lived his whole life in government, that he was a businessman. And I think some people that's his pitch. And that's been his pitch over the past, you know, since 2016. So I think people saw that pitch. They tried out that pitch. It was very interesting to them. And for some people, they didn't like how it turned out. And I think now, you know, her pitch of when she said in the past, I've been in government my whole life, it kind of feels like, oh, another government person. But I think now there's sort of this thinking that's evolving of like, oh, no, she's fought her whole career for this. She doesn't just want power now. I think it's an argument that can resonate.
A way to sum that up is Trump comes from outside the government and he says the government is a problem and we need to decrease it in size. I think that's a standard kind of conservative Republican argument. But more than that, we need to restaff it and, you know, de-liberalize it. It's a problem and I come from outside of it and I will radically reshape it to make it work for Americans. Again, that's his pitch. Hers is, I want to use the tools of government to help make people's lives better. And that's what I've been doing my whole career. So you have these two kind of, and obviously I'm being generous and painting in broad strokes here, but you have these two kind of fundamental different approaches to what it means to be president. One is I need to bring the government to heel and control it and reshape it. The other one is I need to influence who it helps and how it helps. And I don't know. I think, again, taking away the personalities, because I just refuse to believe that there are people who don't have views on Donald Trump and don't have views on Kamala Harris. But it is really a difference in the role of government in American life. And that's kind of what every election in the US has been for a long time, right? At the end of the day. And there's been different ways that's manifested, different quotes, different slogans. You've got Reagan's kind of like the scariest sentence in the English language is, I'm from the government and I'm here to help you. You've got that kind of pitch. And then you've got the Obama, much more like, I guess, more like the Harris pitch, which is, yes, we can hope we can make life better by using the tools of government. So I guess that's their closing arguments. But in a weird way, you have to really dig at Trump. You have to dig at Harris. I think she's only just made that clear in the last like couple of days. But you have to dig at Trump to be generous. Because, I mean, the rally in New York last weekend on Sunday night was a tough watch for anybody who is not a MAGA diehard, because I don't think that didn't appeal to a lot of folks outside his base. I wouldn't have thought, Kristen.
Yeah. Wait, John, give a rundown of what he said, because I almost can't even remember exactly what his pitch was because it got lost up in so much of the other coverage of speakers who were approved by them to speak.
Right. And part of that is because the media is really trying to hammer Trump. I don't think there's any way around that. I don't think that you can argue that the mainstream media is not in the tank for Harris, but Trump didn't make headlines in that because his speech was fairly normal for Trump. He did say things like, I'm going to deport. What did he say? He said he ran out the old lines on deporting, you know, millions, maybe more illegal immigrants. But again, while that is a fairly radical policy in the scheme of things, it's not radical. He's been saying that for months, you know, so it isn't news. He said potentially cutting income tax to zero. Nothing new. He didn't break any news in that, and he didn't say anything hugely outrageous during that rally. And I have no idea. Maybe that's because his handlers had already said, oh my God, this rally is going to be a problem in the media tomorrow. Like they're going to focus on the comedian's comments about Puerto Rico being garbage. They're going to focus on people saying Harris is the devil or whatever. So you need to just stick to your policy lines, or whether he just kind of, that's what he wanted to say. But the reality is what he said and what was said doesn't matter. And I include the garbage line. Like, I just think that's a joke. Like, a bad joke from a pretty unfunny comedian, but who cares? Like, I really believe that this stuff doesn't really matter. I'm talking about the comedian. Yeah, again, I'm going to assume that most of our audience who are listening to us and reading our newsletter know what happened, but the comedian who kind of called Puerto Rico a floating island of garbage, like, it's a nasty thing to say, and a well-run campaign probably doesn't let that guy get close to a microphone because he's a roast comedian. But also, I don't know. I just find it really hard to get outraged by this stuff. I think the bigger takeaway from that rally, and I wasn't there, but reading about it and watching it, is just that the environment that the Trump campaign wants to create is very much a rabid kind of, I won't say super extreme, but it's this kind of hyped up, energetic, like cauldron of emotion about, oh, we want to deport immigrants. We want to be rude and mean. It's not a kind environment. It's a rude, mean. We've got to take back our government. We've got to like destroy things. We've got to be like, you know, the country's going to hell. We've got to, you know, it's this, again, I'm trying to be careful with my words because I don't want to be like, oh, he's violent rhetoric and all this kind of stuff. But it is violent rhetoric, right? It is this apocalyptic image of America unless you elect Donald Trump. The words kind of don't matter. It's the vibe of the thing. And again, none of that is new though. Like you don't have to go very far to see this, you know, in his rallies everywhere. So I don't know. I don't think anybody sits there and goes, oh my God, I think Trump is a bad guy, or now I love Trump. Like, you had your views already. I'm skeptical that Puerto Ricans in Pennsylvania are going to move the needle because of a comedian's comment, but maybe I'm wrong. I just think it's, what was I saying to you the other day, Kristen? I think I was saying, I kind of resist this arms race of outrage. The idea that you are just looking for something to get really upset about because that's what's going to change the election, whether it's this guy's comment about garbage or Trump now turning up and trying to capitalize on Biden's comment about his supporters being garbage, or whatever the comment is, it is an arms race for outrage. You just end up like, who can get more outraged? And I don't think that wins the election. B, it's also just, God, it's a nasty environment to have to conduct your politics in.
Totally. Yeah. It's sort of this like anarchist feeling. But I think it's totally lost on people. I think the rage bait, I think people have just canceled it out if they haven't made up their mind, or if they already don't. Like, there was actually a really good piece in, Embedded today, which is sort of a Substack newsletter, but it was talking, they interviewed the Semaphore media correspondent, Max Tani, and he, now there's been this shift where liberal media and liberals have distrusted, there's a rise in sort of distrust over the media from liberal Democrats because they're saying, well, why don't you cover these things? Why don't you call Trump a fascist? Why don't, right? Mm-hmm. And he was saying, you know, everything. So people don't understand that any sort of media that comes to you, that is media. Any post you see, that is media. Like, there's a fundamental misunderstanding of the information that you receive and how it's so drawn out by an algorithm. Like, you're not seeing news on Trump if that is not what you engage well with. Yeah.
Let's put a pin in that, because I think that's an interesting point to come back to when we talk about, I want to talk about the Washington Post saga over the last week or so. But quickly, just rounding up the rest of the news before we get into the foreign policy stuff and the media stuff. There was some economic news out this week. I think it was put out, I can't remember who put it out, but it was official government, you know, reporting. GDP, American GDP adjusted for inflation expanded at 2.8% as an annual rate in the third quarter. Inflation numbers were broadly in line with what they've been, which is coming down. I mean, they're still not great, but all that kind of stuff. So what I'm saying is that the picture, the economic picture that was painted by, I think it was the Commerce Department, on Wednesday, so yesterday, we're recording on Thursday, was a one of a strong U.S. economy, or at least a relatively strong U.S. economy in world terms. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that people feel like the economy is going well for them, because obviously GDP growth isn't equally distributed through the economy. But I don't know. Do you think that's going to affect the election? Do you think that news is good or bad for anybody?
Yeah. I mean, I think that if it were bad, it would affect things a lot more, right? Because it could feed right into the talking points of any opposition. So whether that be the Trump campaign, whether that be Stein, whether that be any third party candidate that are getting a certain amount of traction. I know we actually haven't delved into that, but I mean, they have. And so I think it would hurt if it were bad, but it seems like it's right in line. So it kind of fell flat, you know, was written up and then forgotten.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. I think it doesn't change anything. I think if you have a view that the economy is bad, that things were better under Trump, that inflation is too high, that grocery – and, you know, that's something I've sat in on a ton of focus groups in the last couple of months for whatever reason. And something I hear over and over and over again is it's ridiculous going to the supermarket. It's insane. Like I can't get out of there for less than $150 for a family of two or four or whatever it is. And I think, you know, you saw Kamala Harris announce a fairly odd policy a couple of months back, or maybe even a month back, about price gouging and supermarket companies ripping you off. It's clearly a concern of voters that they feel everything is really, really expensive. So like, I don't think this news, I don't think some boffins from the Commerce Department coming out and saying, oh, GDP is strong and like, look at the rest of the world and we're the envy of the world. That's not going to change how people feel when they go and buy groceries. But what it does do, and I couldn't agree more with you, is it denies the Trump campaign a super powerful talking point. So over the last week, we've got racism. We've got Trump is an extremist. He's a fascist. We talked about that last week. If that news had come out yesterday and it had been bad, the Trump campaign could have pivoted to something that resonates with people who don't like him. If you're a moderate, undecided, and you're like, I don't like Trump. I don't like him. I don't know if I can vote for him. And then the economy looks like it's going bad, and his campaign for the last 4 or 5 days can go, I will make you richer. I will bring down the cost of stuff. It's a disaster. That's a powerful argument. And these numbers mean he can't really do that, right?
Yeah. Yeah, what's actually is a good point, right? Because we are less than a week away. So any argument that you can grab on could be particularly salient.
Particularly if it's backed with data and isn't just appealing to your base either or. Like it's not, you don't want to make, you know, DEI arguments or like woke arguments if you're on the left, because that's not getting anybody who doesn't really like you. And you don't want to make MAGA based kind of crazy arguments on the right either. You want these economic, immigration, mainstream arguments backed with data that you can kind of be like, hey, I'm not actually crazy. The world isn't that good or whatever.
Yeah. You want these still on the fence people. I saw someone shared an Instagram story yesterday and they were like, if you think you're still on the fence, we exist. And she was like, take this poll or whatever. And I was like, wow, the undecided, they do exist and they want
to be
heard.
Special. And they want to be, I mean, the idea that undecided voters in this country aren't focused on enough is absurd, but anyway, very quickly, this is something that I'm sure everybody has heard 1,000 times, but I'm getting pretty worried, Kristen, about the post-election period. We talked about it last week, but Pennsylvania looks like it will be the most likely state to swing the election. And by that, I mean, if Harris wins it, she probably wins the election. If Trump wins it, he probably wins the election. And he's come out in the last 24 hours with a couple of posts on Truth Social, Donald Trump, that is, saying they're stealing it already. We have people are being locked up for stealing it. Pennsylvania voters are fraudulent, you know, that we have to stop the steal. You know, I'm paraphrasing again, but he's gone pretty all in.
He's planting the seeds.
Yeah, well, I think he's doing even more than that in terms of like how it sounds. He's saying it is happening. People are being caught, which obviously is planting the seeds, but he's alleging it outright. You know, I haven't seen any evidence of that anywhere else. I'm getting pretty worried, Kristen, that one way of interpreting that is that their internal poll numbers on the Trump campaign aren't great for Pennsylvania, and he's leveraging up the stakes on that. But I'm getting pretty worried that if he loses, there is almost zero chance he concedes, and a fairly high chance that he claims it's stolen again. And he has Musk on his side, who has been posting similar things and will presumably back his claims that the election was stolen if he loses, and has Twitter, a really powerful dissemination tool. I don't know. Am I overreacting to that, or do you feel like it's a risk?
No, I think it's a very It's a very worrisome risk, especially that he has Musk on his side, who's also putting out figures and presenting them in a way that is a little bit dubious.
He puts out spreadsheets of numbers saying early voting, and like everybody who's on Twitter goes, "Oh, look at that deep spreadsheet." I'm not going to dive into the numbers, but that's evidence, and it's not evidence.
Right. Yeah, and exactly. If he can control the information atmosphere and have certain things be amplified and retweeted and whatnot, that's really dangerous. I don't know if there's, is everyone on Twitter, are people who are not deeply obsessed with media and whatnot on Twitter to an extent where it could sway things? Maybe not, but it can very quickly go into the other social spheres, the Meta, and, can all the other information networks clamp down on that? They have to obviously make decisions at that moment. I'm more worried about the information flow, the misinformation, the disinformation, even though that's like so buzzword central that is, almost loses meaning within itself. But totally. I mean, I think everyone's really concerned about that post-election period, and with good reason.
Yeah. I mean, I agree. Twitter has always been a shitty social network in the sense of like only very online, very self-assured people think are on it. And I'm including myself on that. Although I have plans to get off Twitter after the election, which I'm saying publicly, so people hold me to it. The power of Twitter has always been that the elite are on it. Journalists are on it. Journalists live on it. And journalists write articles that then get funneled into the mainstream media that then normal people who don't live their lives online because they've got better things to be doing, they read that. And so the worry here is, and I think Twitter has had X, whatever you want to call it, has had a huge degradation in its reputation. So maybe it doesn't happen. Maybe the mainstream media won't publish articles based off Twitter this time around like they have for the last 10 years. But there is no doubt in my mind that if Trump loses the election, Twitter will become – the algorithm will be manipulated to post overwhelmingly pro the election was stolen information. What happens from there is less clear to me. And I think I said last week or the week before – in 2020, Trump was unsuccessful in getting widespread buy-in to his narrative of the election was stolen because no major person, and when I say person, I mean politician, I mean media figure, I mean business executive, no major figure went with him. A lot of Republicans came out in the immediate aftermath and said, no, it wasn't stolen. Musk wasn't a thing then. He was kind of on the sidelines. Republican governors who are popular in their state didn't go with him. They may have been like, oh, I don't know, but they didn't back his claims. It was really just Trump and his inner circle of advocates who, Rudy Giuliani, who was discredited long before then. But this time, so basically I don't think it worked because no one kind of bought into it. I am worried, Kristen, this time that it will not be the case. Musk will absolutely buy into it, plus a ton of Silicon Valley folks, I think, will buy into it. And if one or two seemingly reasonable Republican governors who don't have a reputation for backing Trump, so I'm not talking about like folks like Tom Cotton or Marjorie Taylor Greene, because no one listens to them on this stuff. But if someone like, trying to think, but like Marco Rubio or another like national figure who is seen as more reasonable says, I think it was stolen. Boy, I think this narrative could really take off, and it could be a problem.
And then, I guess, then the question is, what sort of problem does it become? Is there a recount? It gets into speculation, but it is valid questions, and maybe we should even look into that more and kind of the legal pathways and.
There's this whole complicated stuff around certification of your state's electors from the Electoral College and what happens then. And obviously then it goes to the Senate and then, Kamala Harris potentially has to ratify her own election. So there's all these complex legal things. But I think it's a much more simple problem than all of that. It's if a ton of the American population, and I'm not talking about MAGA diehards because they'll do whatever Trump says, but I'm talking about reasonable folks. If a ton of those people have doubts about the credibility of the US election, what happens on Inauguration Day? What happens? It's a real problem for the ongoing health of American democracy. And maybe I'm over, maybe I'm doing the elitist media thing where it's like, oh my goodness, like everything's terrible. Maybe it doesn't matter. Maybe if Harris wins, everyone thinks she shouldn't, well, 50% of the country thinks she shouldn't win, but she still is the president and the military still obeys her and life goes on. Maybe, but maybe not. Maybe the military, just there's a lot of folks who lean right in the military and maybe they go, you know what, I'm not going to serve under her. Or maybe police in places encourage people to riot. I don't know, but like it's kind of like you never know, because how do you pinpoint the breaking down of a riot or a political situation before it happens? And I'm very, and I think if I'm political in this country, because I obviously don't vote and I'm a foreigner, it is that I really dislike people challenging the outcomes of elections based on nonsense. Like some elections are fraudulent, or like there are issues, and there were issues in 2020 for sure. We've talked about this, 370 million people voting, whatever is in America. There are going to be issues. That's a huge logistical undertaking. But the idea that you refuse to concede when you know you've lost is a real problem for me. And I don't know. Again, who knows what's going to happen, but we should be watching it. All right. Enough on that, I think. Very quickly, I wanted to talk about the Washington Post decision to not endorse Trump. Do you have any views on this? This is Jeff Bezos.
And the LA Times.
The LA Times, yeah.
Yeah, lots of opinions on this, mostly that I think it's rubbish that any newspaper would ever endorse. And it's, I want to back this up with intrigued readers' reaction. So we asked our, 100,000 plus, I don't even know all the latest figures, like it's way more than that.
115, I think, at the moment.
Yeah. And it's like, we asked them, we got responses, many to our daily polls.
Thousands.
Should newspapers endorse? And I think 60-something% said no. And then it was like 30 for yes, and then something and then other. And I really felt like, okay, I'm not just of, an obscure opinion when I saw that. And we've talked to many of our readers, highly respected, many of them, very high positions in companies, government, et cetera. And so, it doesn't even seem like it's the non-mainstream to believe that.
Why do you
that
think
newspapers
that pages-
shouldn't?
But why do you think papers shouldn't endorse? Like, so I mean, it's unfortunate it's unfortunate for the podcast that I agree entirely with you, because it makes it less interesting than if I disagreed with you. But tell me why you think major newspapers shouldn't endorse.
So major newspapers should focus on telling the news, which journalists do on a day-to-day basis, right? Like whatever journalist covers Trump, Harris, White House, Congress, they were of no part any decision in that meeting room when that happened. Jeff Bezos owns the Washington Post, and ultimately who the Washington Post endorses, I am willing to put money on, that it really comes down to Jeff Bezos's decision, which he did. He came out and he actually defended why the Washington Post did not endorse. Why does Jeff Bezos get to speak on behalf of this newsroom, set such a tone, use a global brand, and endorse a candidate when probably hundreds of his readers don't agree with him? And that just really is not the business that media is in my opinion, or should be.
So the argument against it, to my understanding, would be whoever owns it, the newspaper should have like a complete independence. The editor, the editor-in-chief, the publisher, they should be able to make their own decisions. And, outside of business decisions, which the owner presumably should be involved in, like the editorial decisions should be entirely independent. And it shouldn't matter what Bezos says. So I guess people are outraged that the idea of a billionaire owning a newspaper means he can influence what those editors think. But I agree with you entirely that that's like, That's kind of an argument down the stack from a higher argument, which is why are editorial people at newspapers endorsing a candidate for president? Now, a columnist, an individual columnist who comes in with an editorial on, I think Trump is better for president, or I think Harris is better for president, being published in a newspaper, that's fine. That is a, as long as it's labeled as editorial opinion by a single columnist, I'm fine with that. You know, go and find five of the smartest people and ask them to write their best case for their candidate to help people think through the issues. Fine. But why as a newspaper, as a business, like that's like saying like, oh, Weetabix or, well, that's a brand, but like Kellogg's should take a position on the election. The Washington Post should be a place, and the New York Times and the LA Times and every media organization, in my opinion, or major media organization, should be a place where everybody feels they can go and work and have opinions. And if you have an editorial line as a company, don't tell me that Republican, like MAGA people can go work there. They're going to feel like they're working in the enemy's nest. And that's one of the biggest problems with media, Kristen, is not that we shouldn't have media companies as a whole that are left or right. Fox News being right, New York Times being left. They should have a bunch of left and right people in them that report the news and ideally balance each other out and have opinions that are left and right. But when you have whole media organizations being left or right, I think it's a real problem because it means that people then, as you said before, wall themselves off to get only the news they like. Reading, you know, I subscribe to the New York Times because it does a really good job of, you know, on the ground reporting all around the world. It's got a lot of money, so it has the resources. But like, there's no doubt that they are not reporting things that are bad for Harris or not fully, you know, they're glossing over them. And they're definitely reporting everything Trump does that's bad. And like, I don't know, like that doesn't feel newsy to me. That feels like I'm being told what to think and being told how to vote.
Yeah. I also think, so do you know Barry Weiss, like the Free Press?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that
she used to love the New York Times, right? She used to be at the New York Times. Mm-hmm, now she's kind of like libertarian, contrarian thinker.
And not that, I mean, I have a lot of friends who think she's a grifter and whatever. I think she writes a really compelling columnist. Not that I underscore the vast majority of them or really am all that happy when I read the Free Press articles for various reasons. But one of the big reasons she left the New York Times, which I do think there's validity there, is that she said there needs to be a more nuanced conversation around Trump. And that has appealed to many people. And you've seen the NPR, an NPR editor wrote a whole tell-all on NPR and then went to the Free Press. You've seen that happen in media where they don't feel represented. Editors, reporters, et cetera, don't feel represented in their newsroom. And these new outlets that are trying to kind of like mish and do the both of them have gained talent. And yeah, I think these behemoths though, right? Washington Post, New York Times, it's so hard to change around thinking.
Yeah. I mean, last word on this, I suppose, because we've got a lot to get to, and I warn people it's going to be a longer podcast today, but we don't want to, you know, go Joe Rogan on this and go for 5 hours. But I think it's I'm hopeful that this Bezos decision and as you said, the Patrick, whatever the guy's, the owner of the LA Times name is, I'm hopeful that these decisions kind of normalize newspapers not officially endorsing for president. And I'm hopeful that the University of Chicago's approach to things like politics and you know, protests on their campuses mean that most universities will now adopt this neutral stance as well. Because I'm on the record many times saying organizations shouldn't take political positions. They can have policies internally that make people feel included and, you know, all of that stuff's fine. But outwardly having political positions on our organizations is just not good for the health of society. It's no wonder that people don't want to hear when people disagree with them because they just get fed this constant stream of algorithms that tells them that they're very smart and everything that they think is right. Companies that want them to buy new products so tell them that they think they're right. Newspapers who want subscriptions so they tell them everything they think is right. And it's just this world where you can cocoon yourself off from everybody who disagrees with you. And then, of course, you have this view that the world is the way you see it and that anyone else who doesn't see it like that is evil and awful and shitty and all this other stuff. And I mean, maybe it's a mid-century, like little L liberal in me that just goes like, we should be able to kind of have conversations with people who don't agree with us and go, oh yeah, but they're not bad people. And I hopefully newspapers not endorsing officially is a step maybe in that direction, but maybe I'm being too naive.
Yeah. I mean, I grew very disenchanted with sort of virtual signaling from covering ESG at the FT.
Which is the classic version of that, right?
Right. It's a classic version. And it's sad because there was such good energy and intention behind it, I think, when ESG first started. And especially, I mean, I covered more from a finance lens. So it's like, how do we change our systems to incorporate different metrics, right, to how we lend and think about economic metrics? But yeah, but now even CEOs, they don't want to put their head above the parapet. They don't want to say things. And that might be, you know, right. Does Weetabix, the CEO, need to tell you how he feels for you to, you know, go
and
make your own
that,
decisions?
Do they need to be posting, you know, about the latest political trend, whatever it is, whether DEI and all this kind of stuff. I think the causes of these things, whether you agree with them or not, are ultimately hurt by being co-opted by corporations, newspapers, rich people.
Then they unionize and they lay people off what the heck? I thought you said that you cared and now you don't, right? So it gives rise
in a democracy with freedom of thought and freedom of speech to MAGA movements where a critical mass of people coalesce around the idea. Hey, it's like, hey, that's not what I think. Don't tell me that's what I think. And people like Donald Trump or other politicians in other countries are able to harness that, and it can be quite destructive. But again, I hope this is a correction back into a world of like, we can agree disagreeably disagree agreeably. All right, Kristen, let's move on to the guts of this podcast. And maybe at the start of the podcast, you can put a marker in to tell people who want to skip all of our musings about these things to get straight to the foreign policy. But we want to talk about the Harris administration, the Trump potential administration, what these folks would do differently on foreign policy. We've talked about it a few times during election intrigues run since the start of the year around the start of the year. But let's sum it up. So let's start with the Harris administration. Her core foreign policy in one line, tell me if you disagree with me. More of the same as Biden: predictability, stability, harnessing allies, global America. That's probably
Agreed.
Not one line, but
check. Continuation.
Yeah. Okay. Is there anything you'd add to it? Do you think there's anything she would diverge from the Biden administration on?
No, I think she's tried to use language in her campaign to dupe people into thinking she'll treat Israel in some way differently. No, I think she's just added sometimes a figure of like, wow, I feel really bad these many people are dead, but that's it. Nothing's going to change.
Yeah. I mean, one of the themes of this section and my belief on how governments run generally is that personnel makes policy, not the other way around. You know, obviously you set a policy and you hire people who agree with you, but realistically, people in government and organizations and administrations are the ones who make the policy. And I think the stability comes from, we don't expect her to hire people who are particularly outside the mainstream. She'll probably hire pretty extensively from the foreign policy blob in DC. And I also think that she herself, and this is based on not much reporting other than just my sense, I don't think she's that interested in foreign policy. I think she's a domestic policy person. I think she's a person who cares more about law, injustice, you know, women's rights, these domestic issues that matter a lot to Americans. I think Biden does care about foreign policy. He's had a long record in the Senate of being on the Foreign Relations Committee and all these kinds of things. So I think he took an interest in this stuff. And I think Harris will obviously have a foreign policy, but I don't think she really wants to focus on it. So I don't think, I don't think she's going to come in and go, aha, I've been thinking very deeply about all of these issues and here's a huge divergence in what we're going to do. So I agree with you. Why don't you talk us through, you've done a bit of reporting on this and a lot of research on who might make up her foreign policy administration, if I will. So talk us through who you think will fill potential key spots.
Yeah, I think she also doesn't want to spend a bunch of her time on foreign policy. I think she wants to put a very competent Secretary of State in place and defense secretary in place and not have to ring them every day, you know, and feel like they are chugging along and doing what they need to do. So Linda Thomas Greenfield, her name has been thrown around. She's the U.S. ambassador to the U.N. So she's the one who sits around when you see those photos of the U.N. Security Council. She's a Black woman. She is a really talented diplomat. She's done a lot of work on Sudan, if I believe, and got a lot of kudos for that prior to even the past few years. And she is really floated as a top choice. I will say, I wonder her, and this is unfortunate. I mean, she's taken directives from Washington. You know, if she believes it personally or not is something different. But she has vetoed a ceasefire resolution at the UN Security Council 3 times. It was from a period of, you know, October of last year to I think June of this year. And so these images of her raising her hand for the veto,
yeah,
have just politically really tough. Politically tough. And they, I would say, I think they went pretty viral to a degree where it was like outside of just media folks. You know, it was on Instagram stories. That's always my barometer.
The UN ambassador job is such a tough one because basically you're just asked to eat a shit sandwich on behalf of the administration most of the time. Anything the Secretary of State doesn't necessarily want to get photographed on, you're going to be the point person for it. And the UN only deals with stuff that no one wants to deal with. So I agree with you. I would say the counterpoint would be she would be a very well, like, if the Harris administration wants to have a continuation of policy, I suspect those vetoes would probably let her have some credibility with Netanyahu, potentially. I think that the politics of Gaza become way less important after the election in terms of American politics. Like,
yeah, and she'll get past Congress. Like, that's the other thing. And I'll right. Like, when I go into the other names that have been floated, which is Chris Coons, Chris Murphy, who actually just wrote a whole op-ed in the FT on foreign policy. They're both senators. They're both pretty well-liked senators. And so really it's, you need someone who can get through that congressional review process.
And the Senate will almost certainly be a Republican Senate at that point. Although
yeah.
I think to prevent nominations, you have to have a filibuster. I'm not sure on that stuff, but they'll have to at least put someone up that the Republicans can't object to, you know, they can't put someone yeah. far left up, for example.
Who I'm really interested and curious in and have really put a marker on is, so the former U.S. ambassador to Turkey, Jeff Flake, who yes. was a senator previously, he came out and endorsed Harris last
month. He's a never Trumper, right? He's a Republican. He's a pretty establishment Republican, never Trumper kind of
yeah,
guy.
Yeah, kind of like a Mitt Romney.
Got run out of office by MAGA, right? Essentially.
Right. But he did wonders for the Turkey US relationship and really worked hard on that over the past few years. And I could see, I think he's really trusted in Turkey and really well respected.
And she said she's going to appoint a Republican to her
cabinet,
senior positions in her cabinet, right? And I think that'd be a great choice. You know, foreign policy should be bipartisan. So, yeah, that's a good shout.
Yeah, I mean, I've met him a few times. He's a really interesting, ooh, nice
so
guy. I don't know about that. But yeah, he does. And he's actually really pretty friendly with the media, which is always nice. Like sometimes he just, I think he understands his role. He understands the media's role. It's always annoying when politicians don't. It's sort of like, did you think no one was going to ask you anything? Like, is that, that's kind of ridiculous. So yeah, I would be most in favor of him.
Yeah. And National Security Advisor, we've already talked about potentially being Phil Gordon, who has been on her team for a long time. He's well respected, but he very inside the beltway, very blobby, but that doesn't matter so much with the National Security Advisor because that is really a very internal facing political / bureaucratic role, right? Like the Secretary of State is much more of a political, outward going America on the world stage job.
Yeah, well, and even when you look at who Biden sent to the Middle East, for example, it hasn't been Sullivan as much. It's been Bill Burns, it's been Hochstein, it's been McGurk. So it's National Security Advisor probably isn't going to be traveling as much or having to be.
It's not an office of state, really. It was created not that long ago as kind of, yeah. I think, much more of like a coordinating the intelligence, foreign policy, and military functions from someone who has the direct ear of the president. It's kind of like a coordination and policy setting role rather than kind of an engaging. I mean, they do obviously engage with their counterparts overseas, but it's not the primary one. Okay. So let's move on to, basically what we're saying here is the Harris administration would probably appoint people who are fairly middle of the road, who are experienced, who have credibility. You may not, you know, love them, but they're not going to be someone who you're like, whoa, where did that come from? Like,
why they're not going to be a VC
plucked her friend
tech
from
guy.
San Francisco. Yeah, exactly right. Let's turn to the Trump administration. Foreign policy approach in one line. Tell me if you think I'm right. Unpredictable deal-making transactional approach leading to high-risk, high-reward for America and for America's allies.
Yes, except I would say maybe initially pretty predictable. I think some of his first moves will be like, okay, he's been saying that and he's probably trying to do something with that. I think throughout his term, it will be chaotic in the sense that you don't necessarily know what he's going to do. So unpredictable maybe after the first 6 months, but not the first six per year.
Good. So again, not a massive difference from his first term where he was willing to shake the snow globe of international relations and see where the snow fell, to extend that metaphor a bit too far. In terms of team composition, what do we know? We know that Rick Grenell, who is the former ambassador to Germany and was, I think, for a very brief period, his Trump's national security advisor and towards the end of his first term, is he being talked about for Secretary of State?
Yeah, he is. And actually someone who is really high up at a German bank just told me at the IMF meetings when they were in town that they were like, yeah, I was like, well, and he's like, I know some people from the Trump team from their time. And he was like, I'm pretty sure it will be Rick Grenell. I think that just might be confirmation bias of knowing him because I think interacted with him when he was in Germany. But he's been very loyal to the Trumps, both Donald Trump himself, but also the family. He's allegedly in business deals with the Kushners in the Balkans, which
we know
he was a special envoy for.
Almost characteristic number one for Trump, right?
Yeah, which I think would be challenging to potentially get past the Senate. And that's where, you know, or get past the Senate, get past Congress. And so I could see that being a quite hard hearing. So where someone like a different senator, like maybe Bill Hagerty, I've also heard that name thrown around quite a bit recently from Tennessee senator, that could, again, be a little bit better of a in terms of getting it through Congress. But I don't actually think that Trump cares so much.
From his first term.
No, I think I feel like Mike might be considered more for DOD, Defense Secretary, than State. But I could be wrong. You know, he could come back as State.
To go back to what we were saying, you know, about his foreign policy, he's unpredictable. And I mean, one school of thought is, you know, you had Rex Tillerson as his first Secretary of State, the ExxonMobil CEO, like that came from kind of nowhere really in his first term. So we know that Trump is not afraid to kind of pluck someone that he has a good rapport with, who is kind of a big deal in whatever the field is and not necessarily experienced in government. But I also think that there's a lot of reporting about that first Trump administration was so shocked that they won, that they really didn't know how to fill those key spots and they only had a couple of months to do it. And, you know, that maybe that speaks to Trump having more plans or better ingrained plans. Then obviously you've got the Project 2025 stuff where there's a lot of organizations around the Trump orbit now who are saying, we're not going to let him be unprepared again. We're going to have a list of names for every job possible. I was reading a New York Times article this morning about the CEO of there's a company, a financial company in New York. Anyway, I'll get his name and I'll come back to you. But a guy who's basically just staffing up a potential Trump administration who's been doing it for the last year. And so like there'll be names and they're going to be very Trump loyal. They're going to be not necessarily doesn't care what other people think of them, probably outside the blob to the extent that he can do that. So again, this goes back to Trump's foreign policy. Personnel makes policy. Trump will staff it with people who are loyal to Trump first and foremost. He won't make the mistake of hiring another John Kelly or another establishment person who has ideals to something other than Trump and Trump's policy positions. So that means Trump will be unpredictable. He will, whatever Trump decides to say on any given day, we can presume that whoever he staffs those key positions with will not push back on him. And we know that Trump is mercurial. So one day he'll come out and say, Xi Jinping's a great, strong leader and I'm jealous. The next day he'll say, they're eating our lunch and we need to smash them with tariffs.
Mm-hmm. I always wonder what incentivizes these people, because like if you take on a big corporate job, like if they fire you after 6 months, like, okay, you got a big payout, right? At least probably, hopefully they give you a huge severance. It's like, what, do you just go to get to be a lobbyist and just like go back to making a bunch of money? I mean, I guess they were probably all billionaires anyways. Anyways, okay, so.
It's power too. Like you genuinely.
It's power, yeah.
Last thing on that, I wonder, J.D. Vance, one interesting thing I want to mention before we move on to the final bit of our podcast. J.D. Vance interestingly put a little bit of distance between the U.S., Trump administration, and Israel. He said, and I'm going to just quickly look up the quote here because it was really, I thought it was, I hadn't heard the Trump administration or the Trump orbit say anything like this before, but he said, Israel has the right to defend itself, but America's interest is sometimes going to be distinct. Sometimes we're going to have overlapping interests, and sometimes we're going to have distinct interests. And our interest, I think, very much is in not going to war with Iran. Now, that's a normal statement for a policy person. Hey, we've got our own interests. We work with our allies. Sometimes we don't agree. We move on. But when it comes from J.D. Vance, that's really interesting to me because that's the first time I've ever heard any distance between Trump and what they say and Israel.
Israel. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But what it does give me a sense of is like the policy at the top of the stack when it comes to foreign policy for Trump people is no new wars, isolationism, and no foreign involvement where we can get away with it. So the idea that they would potentially break with Israel because they don't want to go to a war in Iran, well, what's going to trump in that situation if Israel goes to a war with Iran? Is it the alliance with Israel and they support Israel? I think in the Harris situation, they would begrudgingly support Israel. They would say, we don't want this to happen, but we're back our allies. Maybe the Trump administration wouldn't back Israel in a war with Iran. I don't know.
Yeah, I think that they want out of one war and it's unclear which war they can get out of first right now. And so it's best to put space between all. So.
And that goes to like another potential senior Trump administration appointee might be this guy called Eldridge Colby, who was a Defense Department official. He has kind of disappeared from the public view of late, but he is big on the idea that China and Taiwan is where World War III is going to happen. And everything else America does is a distraction from competing with China, and they need to focus on that. So all of that seems fairly consistent that they would pull out of those areas, not necessarily pull out, but they would put a lot less focus on supporting foreign military interventions, I think. Ukraine obviously being one of them. All right.
Okay.
Yeah.
John, I want to hear about, let's do a rapid fire. Who you think, I'm going to just list out countries. You say who you think they want to win and just like, 2-3 words, sentence.
From their perspective, from a foreign perspective.
Exactly, okay. Yeah. Okay. All right, ready? Starting with one of your expertise, China.
Okay. I've talked about this a few times. China, I think, is agnostic. If they were pressed, they'd probably prefer Harris because she's stable and predictable. But I think they would view Trump as a high-risk, high-reward candidate. So I honestly think that they're probably torn and they see upside in both.
Mm-hmm. Okay, India.
Probably fairly similar. I think that Modi and Trump probably would get along a lot better. But also, I don't think Trump would focus on India in the same way that Harris would. So I would say, if they had to choose, I think they'd probably prefer Trump just.
Okay. Europe, but like Brussels, Europe.
Oh, Harris, no question. Okay. Europe, I think their foreign policy, it's been a debacle. They've put themselves so firmly in the camp of the Democrats and Harris that like Trump, if Trump wins, which is again a very likely possibility, Europe's in trouble.
Except for Budapest. Maybe.
Oh, yeah, well, you asked me Brussels, Europe, but I think Orban thinks Europe is in Moscow. But anyway.
Right. Okay, what about Ukraine? They've said they'll work with anyone, but who do they want?
Harris. I mean, I think they're kind of screwed if Trump gets elected. Yeah, no question that it's Harris.
Okay, Taiwan.
That's an interesting one. I think naturally, you know, Taiwan is a very different place to China. I think naturally they'd probably find it easier to work with Harris. But I don't think they would say, I don't think they'd think a Trump administration is a disaster because of what I said before about this notion that America needs to focus on China as the main competitor to American supremacy in the world, and Taiwan being kind of like ground zero for that competition. I think that they would all probably prefer a Harris administration because it kicks the question of what happens in an invasion of Taiwan down the road. But I think they'd work with Trump because they'd be like, well, at least he's more likely to kind of like, if we can manipulate him to thinking that we're really important, we could get way more resources and way more focus than we would otherwise. Again, high risk, high reward.
Yeah. What about like sub-Sahara Africa, South Africa, some of the bigger economies in Africa, Egypt, Cairo, right?
This is a hard one. Semaphore reported this week, I think, that Harris has put together an Africa team led by former Attorney General Eric Holder to kind of really audit the relationships and put them at more of a central seat in Washington. I'm skeptical of that because at the end of the day, there's two things. And this comes from a newsletter. We might post a link in our newsletter. It comes from a guy who writes a really good newsletter on Africa and US foreign policy. He said two things. One, it's just never going to be a strategic priority for America. Like there's not enough money. The geography of Africa is not important to America. Like you can't get around that raw geopolitical fact that Africa doesn't matter to America vis-a-vis Asia or Central America. The second thing is personnel makes policy, and Africa policy attracts people who are interested in development and aid, and it doesn't attract people who are interested in hard strategic power. I'm generalizing. But for those two reasons, I don't see much change in the way either administration will deal with Africa.
Right. Well, maybe in the like Djibouti or the ones that are right there on the Red Sea, those might attract defense, but it's not going to be like broad Africa policy. Agreed. It's going to be development.
Events will dictate what happens vis-a-vis US and Africa. You know, if there's huge terrorist attacks, sure, it could become a huge priority. But, you know, there's not going to be like on day one in my inauguration speech, neither of the candidates is going to go, we're focusing on Africa for the next 4 years.
No. Yeah. Okay. And maybe last, did I ask about Japan?
You didn't. Japan, I think pretty unambiguously would prefer Harris. I think Japan feels like it's in a pretty good position right now with the US. They're a member of the Quad. US relationships with Japan are pretty strong. They've been stronger than they have been in a long time. Trump, again, unpredictable, threatens that status quo that I think Japan is pretty happy with right now. But I did read something recently that the new Japanese prime minister, who's a little bit of a renegade himself, a bit of a character, and fairly, I don't want to say militaristic, but he's not an apologist, that he may be able to forge a pretty good, tight personal relationship with Trump. And I think that, again, with Trump, it's all transactional, it's all personal based. So there's that.
Right.
But overall, definitely Harris.
Yeah, he does want an Asian NATO, and he's pretty kneecapped domestically. So why not go after a foreign policy win?
Right.
Okay, John, thank you so much.
Oh, but before we leave, Kristen, I'm not letting you get away without making a prediction about who's going to win. We can do it quickly because I know you don't want to be on the record, but who do you think is going to win the election? And give me a couple of reasons why and what state is going to be critical.
Only because I think it's safer to say that Trump will win.
Yes, exactly. I'm not asking that. I'm not going to hold you. It's a coin flip. Who do you genuinely think is going to win? Take out your ego. Take out you're not wanting to be wrong. Who do you think is going to win the election?
I think Trump will win. And I think that Michigan will be critical. Michigan, Pennsylvania. Yeah.
You think they'll both go red?
I think Michigan might go red. I'm not sure about Pennsylvania yet.
What do you think is the key reason why? What do you think won him the election or lost Harris the election?
Yeah, well, a key reason? I don't know if that, I don't know if I could narrow it down to one for such a block of voters. Various reasons, but I know that both campaigns are freaking out about Michigan because that's where they all are today.
And
today
Wisconsin.
And tomorrow. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. We've got our first disagreement, really, and I think Harris is going to win. I think that for a couple of reasons. I think polls have been this time at least not over-reporting, but they've been probably pretty accurately reporting Trump's support. I don't think people are afraid to say they support Trump anymore where they were in 2016 and to a lesser extent in 2020. And I think pollsters have made a lot of changes to how they kind of correct for the Trump, kind of the shy Trump supporter. I also think polls are kind of garbage. And I just think that I still believe that Trump has a ceiling. I know that they say that the assassination, he broke through that and lifted it from 46 to 49 or 48. I don't think so. I think Trump has a ceiling. I think women, early voting and women will win the election for Harris. I think it'll be really close. But I think she will win. And I think she will win. She'll lose Georgia. I think she'll win North Carolina. I think she'll win Pennsylvania. And I think she'll win Wisconsin. I'm not sure about Arizona.
Where will she lose? Okay.
Not sure about Arizona. She'll probably lose Arizona. And I think
she'll lose Arizona. Yeah, for sure.
She may lose Nevada. And then Michigan is super close. But I think she's going to squeak at home. But then refer back to my comments about what happens next. And that's where I think it gets problematic. In a way, I just want one of the candidates to smash it so that no one can dispute the election. In a way.
Right, right. And that might just be it. All right.
Thank you, Kristen. Longer podcast this week, but we will be recording next week with a lot more information than we have now.
So a lot next more, week, but yeah.
We'll talk about what's happening next week. I guess we'll have to just figure out what's happening and talk about it as it happens, because it's anything could happen. But anyway, thanks, Kristen. Appreciate it.
Thanks.
Bye.